Hello, and welcome to our program, About Books, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Kathleen Schock with co-host
Lana Collins,
and during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from the San Antonio Express News and talking about
books, and more books. Well, we begin today, Kathleen, with our Invisibility and Discovery, with our book that weaves difficult stories of resolve and resolution. It's titled Crying in the Bathroom, an appropriate place, huh? By Erica L. Sanchez, published by Viking. It has 256 pages at a cost of $27. The review is by Andrew Dansby. He is a staff writer. Erica L. Sanchez doesn't coddle readers with her new book, Crying in the Bathroom, the first of 9 essays skillfully stitched together into a memoir, is titled The Year My Vagina Broke. Her doings in the book mirror the frankness with which she writes about them, delving into dubious relationships, difficult work environments, and other complications that greet an aspiring Mexican-American poet from Chicago who doesn't aspire to fit in so much as to just be heard. The early pieces in the book were with a frustrated energy, and its final essays offer a heartwarming resolution I'll not spoil by describing here. Her third book, Crying in the Bathroom, positions Sanchez as quite capable in just about any format, considering her first book, Lessons on Expulsion, was a collection of poetry. And her second, I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, a best-selling novel. So what will follow here is a question and answer between the author, Erica Sanchez, and our reviewer, Andrew Dansby. Question one. The idea that women feel unheard when they describe pain, mental, chronic, immediate. Crying in the bathroom doesn't dispel that. And she answers, thanks for noticing. And yeah, I feel like there are so many women far worse off than me. And it scares me because I've had some terrible experiences, but I know there are worse ones for people without insurance. Our society doesn't value women. It doesn't acknowledge the experience of motherhood. It purports to do so, but it doesn't. Question two. I was intrigued by the structure of the book. It felt at the outset like a series of essays, despite the cover assertion that it was a memoir. I think it was the La Mela Vida essay in the middle where I noticed something was changing tonally. Pieces that felt isolated were pulled into a larger narrative. And Ms. Sanchez's reply, I didn't realize what it was going to be at the outset. I was kind of surprised my publisher asked if we could call it a memoir in essays. I said, whatever makes it sell more. She laughs. I liked the idea of a memoir, but I never considered myself seasoned enough to write a memoir. But I like how it worked out. The essays do have an arc in a sense. So I think it does both. They're essays, but there's a memoir of a sort in there. Third question, Mr. Dansby asks, so the pieces weren't written necessarily as a singular narrative? And she answers, no, all the essays just came about organically, making them fit together. That wasn't something that came easy, but I like creating that arc while maintaining the integrity of the essays. But it was tricky, trying not to repeat myself. It's hard not to repeat details. There's no formula for it. So that was challenging in a sense. But I liked the challenge, honestly. I did want the essays to be able to stand alone and be part of a tapestry of the narrative. Luckily, I had an editor who I trust very much. Instead of feeling offended by her suggestions, I loved that she saw things I didn't. Our fourth question asked, am I right in thinking it spans pre- and mid-pandemic? Without giving away too much, I know there are parts of your life near the end that are from the past couple of years. Again, she answers, there was some pretty intense revision that took place with the earlier essays, but the last one I wrote right before I turned it in. That one, I felt like I needed to live it so I could write it. But the book was also delayed because of COVID. But it's grateful because that gave me a chance to finesse it, add some things before it came out. I'm a meticulous writer. I take my time with these books. This one took 6 years or so. The last one took 5. The poetry book took 10. I don't care for instantaneous publishing. That's never how I've operated. It's my work, and I love to write. It brings me to a lot of joy. So I want it to be as perfect as I can before letting it go. Now I'm working on a novel. Who knows when that will be finished? Our fifth question asked, I often forget that Sandra Cisneros was from Chicago and House on Mango Street is nearly 40 years old. There are cities with formidable Mexican-American populations that get covered a lot. Chicago just doesn't seem to be one of them. And her reply, yes, people forget about us, and I talk about this all the time. We don't have TV shows or a lot of books about the Mexican community here, but it's large and vibrant. I hope books like mine bring some attention to that. It definitely starts with Sandra, who put us on the map. This idea of Mexicans in Chicago. She inspired me a great deal because I hadn't seen that sort of storytelling anywhere else. And our last question. It feels like the publishing industry is finally making some change. In the past, it felt like it championed a few women or people of color with little sense that they were just a few of many. And her final reply, I'm still disappointed now at what's happening. Our literature has always been kept out of the canon. Few Latina writers have been allowed into the mainstream. I hope we're able to change that. I hope other writers will find more opportunity. It's bigger than any one author. It's bigger than me. But I know what you're talking about. House on Mango Street was published when I was born. When I came of age to read that, her work was so important to me, but I couldn't find much else like it, even though it was a successful book. And again, this book is titled Crying in the Bathroom. It's a number of essays that became her memoir by Erica L. Sanchez.
Thank you so much, Lana. We're going to switch to faith and spirituality. In sacred nature, we can learn a lot from the ancients. The book is entitled Sacred Nature. It's written by Karen Armstrong. The review is written by Andrew Dansby, who is a staff writer with the San Antonio Express News. Karen Armstrong planned another deep dive into the spaces between the known and the unknown with humankind and its host planet. Her career as an author has been defined by compressing infinite and unknowable subjects into readable page counts. Some of Armstrong's works are long by the standards of 21st century's attention spans. She is, after all, the author of A History of God, which covered an impossible-to-cover subject in a mere 460 pages. When Armstrong pitched the new Sacred Nature, her handlers encouraged her to follow a different path. I chatted with my publisher and agent at the beginning of the pandemic, she says, a Zoom conversation. I told them I wanted to write a history of the way religions taught us about the natural world. I thought it was going to be another one of my big fat books. They told me, Karen, this time consider a short one. They told me people need to read this now. Do a long one later. They urged me to talk to people about changing the ways we think about nature. Armstrong compressed centuries into a book that didn't top 200 pages. It's far from exhaustive, which isn't to say it is far from grand in its reach. Restoring an Ancient Bond with Nature. The subtitle to Armstrong's book further explains a title that says a lot on its own, Restoring Our Ancient Bond with the Natural World. Sacred Nature serves as a democratization for faith-based systems over thousands of years. While scientific study offers insight into why things are the way they are, nature, people, people and nature, there remains ample opacity in our existence. Armstrong, in her new book, suggests some cultures had systems that modern culture might classify as quaint. But as we witness natural disaster after natural disaster, perhaps we would do well to engage less with the self and more with our epic surroundings. There is no single easily identified villain in sacred nature. The call in movie cliche parlance is coming from inside the house, so long as we agree that the house is the planet and the killer is us. Armstrong's book is slim, not slight. It offers a polycontinental, multicultural look at the ways faith and space coexisted for centuries. We've maintained the notion of gods, but kicked to the curb ideas of, say, rain gods. And while scientific study prompted some theological purges, Armstrong speaks to the value of such systems. She presents in Sacred Nature ideas like the Greek kenosis, and represents other faith-based systems that held a more reverent affinity for the earth before ecology was a term. The book admires a time before a shift from when the big question was, why are we here, to why are we the way we are? The former query centers the planet with us as its guests. The latter centers us as crucial to a planet that will exist long after it rids itself of us. Armstrong's book gently encourages us to decenter ourselves and find a new humility with regard to the spaces we occupy. We are minuscule creatures in the grander scheme of things, Armstrong says. Before going to bed, before going to sleep, it's worth reminding ourselves how little we know. Turn off the phone. Armstrong uses an internationally familiar entity to illustrate her point for how we misguidedly represent entities across time. When we see the Buddha, he's depicted as sitting calmly and inwardly looking as though he's looking deeply into himself, she says. He's not looking inside himself. He's sending his thoughts and heart out to every corner of the world. She sees cultures across the world as having been constructed similarly, an absence of self in a grander environment. Armstrong's books suggest such communion with nature as crucial. Armstrong remains a defender of faith, despite having been a nun who endured physical and psychological abuse in her convent. Yet hers is not a science versus religion text, the axe grinding of the faithful pushed away by abuse. Rather, she hopes to restore a different sort of faith that some might view as antiquated. There's no good being worried or frightened, she says. That's what paralyzes us to where we can't think properly. We know we have to change our behavior in some way. We can't go on burning fossil fuels as we have. There needs to be a radical change in our thinking and doing. Armstrong clarifies that we don't need to get back to a century before technological advances. Rather, we need to look further behind us, before the 16th century, when Europe departed from the natural world and developed a more pragmatic and utilitarian view of nature. Very interesting reading. The title, once again, is Sacred Nature, and it's written by Karen Armstrong.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Kathleen. And now, I made reference in the previous book I had reviewed for you about Sandra Cisneros, the author. Miss Sanchez gave reference about her, and we have a review about Miss Cisneros. After a hiatus of poetry, it pulled Cisneros through her pandemic. Her book is titled Woman Without Shame, by Sandra Cisneros, published by Knopf, with 176 pages at a cost of $27. This review is by Yvette Benavides. She is a correspondent, but also professor of English at Our Lady of the Lake University and the host of Texas Public Radio's book public podcast. Excuse me. And so we begin. Women Without Shame is Sandra Cisneros' first new book of poetry in 28 years. It includes more than 50 poems on wide-ranging subjects and themes. There are San Antonio poems and poems set in Mexico. There are poems about art, food, and the natural world. Cisneros is 67 now, and though she has never been one to shy away from saying exactly what she thinks, the poems here have an extra edge of candor, a bubbling over urgency, but also a slow simmering wisdom. There are elegies, but also odes to sex and love and being and alive, as alive as ever in her older age, more comfortable in her own skin, unabashed in her expressions about being happiest in her company, blunt, brazen, barefaced, bold. Women Without Shame shows us Sandra Cisneros as perhaps she has always been. And it's not so much that she bares her soul. The more she shares even just the quotidian aspects of her life, the more enigmatic and wondrous the world seems to be for the rest of us. Cisneros recently took time to talk about the new book. The conversation has been edited, though, for length and clarity. Our first question. It's been almost 30 years since you published a book of poetry. You've said over the years that it's difficult to put poetry out there for open consumption by a reading public. Poetry is very close. It's very personal. It's very private. So why is now the right time for this book? Her answer, I never feel an urgency to publish poetry. I feel an urgency to write it. The process of writing is something that I've been doing all along. I have to do it in order to make clarity of emotions, events, and my life. But once I write it, I'm not ever sure whether it's done or whether I want to share it. I need to put it down. Let it have its beauty sleep. So I don't feel the urgency once I write it to publish it. I feel an urgency when I've got that whatever's in my heart that I can't name until I have language. I have that urgency, but publishing's the opposite of writing poetry. For me, writing poetry is like when you get a little thorn in your heart, like from a little prickly pear. You really have to attend to it because it irritates you. Our second question, did you go back to previous poetry collections like Loose Women or My Wicked, Wicked Ways while you were pulling the manuscript together? Her answer, no. Those manuscripts are like looking at photographs of my childhood or looking at my high school yearbook. I've moved past them. I'm not really interested in those poems anymore. There's a few of them that I like, but I don't feel comfortable reading from those books anymore. Our third question. I know you read voraciously and really widely. What does reading poetry by other poets do for you as a writer or as a reader? What does reading poetry specifically do for you? Her answer, I think poetry has been my medicine during the pandemic, where we found ourselves obligated to spend time by ourselves, which for writers is not a punishment. It's like the perfect life. It's like living in a monastery or a convent. And so I indulged. I could clear my calendar, stay home, not put on my shoes, not comb my hair, and just be in a retreat with myself and the world. And I found it was an excellent time to write poetry, because poetry's about being very present at every moment. And I felt myself reading poetry when I felt upset about what was going on in the world politically, what was going on globally. I would reach for poetry, and it would inspire me to write poetry. I like reading writers who make me feel like going to my pen. And our last question, so much of your work is about adapting, not in the sense of giving in, giving up, or conforming, but in the sense of even adapting by clearing a path, finding a way through, because we have a life to live. I kept thinking about that when I read the poems in this collection. And her reply, they're so personal, I think of them like my eyeglass prescription. You can see with them, but this is my eyeglass prescription. So I feel a little astonished that way, because they were written for my eyes. And if they serve you, bueno, I'm glad. And that book once more, it's titled Women Without Shame. It's a poetry book by Sandra Cisneros.
We end with an interview. Art Spiegelman, the cartoonist on a Tennessee school board's move against Mouse, his memoir of family and the Holocaust. The school board of McMinn County, Tennessee, voted on January 10th to stop assigning eighth graders to read Mouse, M-A-U-S, your graphic novel recounting the Holocaust through your family history. Do you take personal offense? Yes, but I can't tell you how mild violent they are. Are these people really idiots, or are they actually sinister forces that have gathered to, like, kill America? I can't tell you to what degree these people carried water for more whacked-out people, the ones who really stand to profit from getting more charter schools in the area that teach religion, thereby taking money away from a public education that needs far, far more to do its job well. Do you read the minutes of the board meeting? Several times. The book was removed from a curriculum. Is that a ban? To use authority to keep people from things, yes, it's a ban, and yet it's not a book burning. Did the burning of comic books launch your career? The Comics Code is what made me, yes. The burning of comic books literally in the 40s and 50s by teachers, clergymen, parents, focused on the same thing these school board people focus on. We have to protect the children as opposed to educate them. But those comic books and that they were burning were getting far more out as they were led into more adult audience. The horror comics and some of the very lurid images in many of the comics were among comics I love the most because they were the kind of on the edge of the forbidden. They were showing me things in their most exaggerated.
All right. Well, thank you. And you have been listening to About Books on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Lana Collins with co-host
Kathleen Schock
saying
goodbye from Owl Radio.